Pat Cook is one of our finest and most talented horsewomen, with an unparalleled life spent breaking, training, producing, showing, and competing horses and ponies. Learning from and working alongside her father, the late, great George Mossman, she knows better than anyone what it takes to turn a bad horse into a good one. But she knows like no other how to manage some of the most talented horses that were simply too hot to handle for anyone else. In this, the first of our two podcasts with Pat and her daughter Sarah, the well-known Scurry driver, we talk about what we now see as a golden age of driving in the mid to late 20th century in the UK, when the show rings were packed and it seemed that the popularity of the sport and pastime would never wane. Pat remembers the remarkable pair of horses she showed with incredible success, Peggy and Portia, who had belonged to the Nicholson family of Vaux Brewery and coaching fame. And she recounts the time that her father cleared out the contents of two harness rooms at the Royal Mews, taking home countless sets of harness in his bull-nosed horse box, and that was the gear and the tack that the family used on a daily basis for all their driving, breaking and training. Most of all, it is the determination, work ethic and horsemanship associated with this remarkable family that has sealed their success and status as one of the leading dynasties in our world of carriage driving.
So we are very, very honoured to be able to welcome Pat Cook from a huge driving dynasty to talk to us about her days with driving and seeing some, you know, showing us some of the things that she's seen over the years, and that those things have been amazing. And we've also got her daughter Sarah with us as well, another avid driver. So hopefully we're just going to have a really good chit-chat, chin-wag about how it all started and where you think it's all going. But really, we want to hear about your story. Where did it all start?
As a small child with a father who obviously was interested in carriages when the combustion engine was coming into being in the early 40s. He was buying carriages that were found in the backs of garages that sort of two for a tenner and all that kind of thing. And I can remember going with him to various places and buying carriages when actually we all lived in a terraced row in Luton. My mother was working in a restaurant to fund it all, and my father was a barrow boy and then a butcher's boy. He then took the job as a butcher's boy in order to drive a butcher's cart with a pony in it. And he would drive 12 miles to do this job on a daily basis. We came along, that job went by the wayside. He started buying carriages, and I can remember an old yard in Luton with carriages all over the place. You walked in, you couldn't get through one, the other, or any of them. And we were just, my mother was working her socks off. Chris and I were looking at new carriages every other day. We didn't know what they were. We were so young. And then it materialized. He started buying the odd horses and then went to the Elephant and Castle, Leicester horse sales, where we would buy sort of end of season hunters and bring them home. He then got some tack and was expected to put all these horses into harness, which if he held the collar up and the horse put its head in it, it was a driving horse. Needless to say, we had many, many, many accidents. Horses upside down, vehicles smashed.
And it was a learning curve.
Absolutely.
I think before we go on further, though, we must just say that your dad was the great George Mossman that so many youngsters hear about even today. And I was brought up on the, gosh, that's George Mossman over there. And of course, your sister is Chris Dick, who was a great driver and somebody who I competed an awful lot. And I have to say that when I was a very snotty-nosed little teenager, actually very young teenager, watching you two drive at Smith's Lawn, and I used to look at them and go, oh my goodness, if I could drive like them even once, I would be thrilled. And you two girls were the people I really looked up to and thought, I want to be like that.
That's very nice of you to say. But he was totally self-taught, of course. He would buy these horses and sort of throw a set of tack on them and learn by what they did or didn't do. And the amount of carriages, because he didn't have a breaking car in those days, we had carriages that he thought, you know, was basically all we had. So, and again, early on in my life, I can remember him, it was in the very early 50s, when he was approached by, it may have been Colonel Miller, but it was certainly the Crown Equerry, to clear out some tack rooms at the Royal Mews. The new Equerry wanted all new tack. So he went there and he bought two tack rooms as they stood. And he went up with big old bull-nosed horse box, I can see it now, and loaded, he went twice, and loaded everything that was in these tack rooms, including Queen Victoria's side saddle and the Prince Consort's saddle, which, as I remember then, they were given to the Victoria and Albert Museum by him. Mm. Whether they're still there or not now, I have no idea. But the rest of it came home. And it was put in a loft above this old shed in Luton, where all these carriages were. And I can remember going up these rickety steps with ceremonial harness like you can only dream of now. Yeah. And hanging it up set by set by set, dozens and dozens, from normal breaking tack to your very superior tack that you would use at a coronation or something with all the crowns on it, silver and everything else. And eventually we took on a small holding at the next village to where we are now. And that's where he started picking up these horses and trying to put them in harness and finishing up in hospital with a fractured skull. And he had a horseshoe on his head. Nobody ever saw him because you never, ever saw him without a trilby or a summer hat on, ever. And he had a scar here, like a horseshoe, and a plate in his head, which was early 50s then. Yeah, he was a one-off, my father, I can tell you. Had the most amazing accidents, serious accidents, and nothing ever put him off. This tack came home, and eventually when he rented the farm that we now own, fortunately, this tack all came up to the Bury, and more horses along the way. He would go buy a lorry load from probably Leicester or the Elephant and Castle or whatever, bring these horses home. Chris and I were expected to show them a bit of tack, and probably he would stick them in harness and we would all be in the ditch quite quickly. But all those years ago, I look back now and think of the amount of horses that were broken here on Bury Farm. And every one that was put in, nearly all the tack was smashed. And we just used to go back into these tack rooms and take a full spelly band, a britching, whatever came to hand that was broken on the horse we were putting in harness, we'd take it off, put it on the vehicle. And over those years, looking back now, I think, I can't believe we ever did it. But there was so much of it. There was dozens and dozens and dozens of sets. And it was only later on in life when I think Chris and I kind of realised what we were all at, that we had a breaking car and then breaking harness. and were able to do the job a little better because my father could never wait. If you had a horse walking on long reins or put its head in a collar or had its blinkers put on and didn't shy back from them, that was going in the vehicle, whatever. It quite often went in and it quite often got out. And we quite often finished up in the ditch and we had runaways and Chris and I used to play around with ponies that he bought along with deals that he had at probably Leicester when he'd buy a bulk lot and there was a couple of ponies involved and we would stick a set of harness on it and put it in a vehicle and it would run away and tip over in the drive and do all sorts of things like that. And we did it for years. Crazy.
But Pat, when he was doing this, were you putting them in as singles or were you all straight away putting these horses in as a half of a pair or multiples?
No.
What was the approach?
9 times out of 10 in single, but not always, because if this horse was going, or, you know, if he when he came to team driving, I mean, he was team driving when I was quite small with, I've got photographs of him driving a team in Luton in a coach. It's embarrassing to look at it because the horses were like skeletons and they were whatever they were, like half-bred Arab with a half-bred Shire or whatever came along. It was stuck in. And even later on in years when Chris and I were more knowledgeable and more able-bodied, he would still say, right, that horse is going on the lead today. We go, but he's not ready. He's not even been in pen. He'll be all right. When Father said, jump, you jumped. It wasn't, we just said, how high? If he said that horse is going in harness, it went in harness. Even when we said, it is not ready, he would put it in.
Mm.
And you couldn't do it today.
Oof, no. Well, we all learn to be a bit more sensible, don't we? Sort of a bit risk-averse these days.
Mm.
And the whole of life has changed anyway. But a huge sort of university of life and learning and reading horses and everything. So that's how you survived, wasn't it?
Yeah. And all these horses that came along, they weren't, if they were a cheap horse, they were bought, whatever they were. And horses, hunters had serious accidents out hunting and got, I can remember horses coming home here with the most appalling wounds and legs more hanging off than on. And in the early days, we had an old boy here who was, he boiled up plants from the hedges and put them round and this, that and the other. And all those things seemed to sort of work. But the amount of horses that came to us that were actual write-offs that were probably put in one of the barns down the yard and shut in there and plenty of hay, plenty of bedding, a bandage around the leg with a dock leaf or whatever came along, and eventually those horses came right. And some of them turned out to be the best horses.
Mm.
That, you know, versatile horses that go lead, wheel, on the team, ridden, driven, postillion, you name it. Out of all those years of horses that we had, I suppose you could probably count on your two hands, the very best of them that would have done whatever job came up. You could just do it. You didn't have to think, will he, won't he? He would do it. From a riding job to, you know, tandem, wheeler, leader, postillion, in the litter with a horse in the front and the horse in the back and the sedan type chair in the centre, and we used to say to him, we can't be doing that. We're doing it, and we're doing it today, he would say, and we did. But we did have quite a lot of accidents, quite a lot of accidents, and broke up so many sets of tack and vehicles, I'm sorry to say.
Yeah, but different life and needs must, and, you know, you can't compare it to today.
No.
This is a completely different era. So when did you start on the competition? Well, I presume BDS started, what, in 57? I can remember seeing you out showing when I was really quite young. So how did that all evolve?
Myself or Chris?
Myself. Oh, you really, but yeah. You know, you should see both of you, but I certainly remember seeing you out showing. You drive pegging Porsche at one stage, I seem to remember.
Yes. I suppose I started showing when Chris met her husband, John. She left us, which my father thought he was never going to get over. But anyway, that's another story. So from then on in, I was able to do so much more. Chris was older, only by 2 years. But as a child, Chris was more gutsy than I was. And we went through all the hunting and the side saddle hunting and all the lovely ridden competitions that were done in those days. And then, of course, we were driving from, I can't remember when I first drove a horse, because my father would put the reins in your hand and you just kind of did it. But we were then having show animals in from various clients in those days, Sir Nigel Coleman and Mrs. Royston, who was a granddaughter of Lord Rothschild, and all those people then who basically, it was difficult to find someone who could deal with a horse and produce it to go in the ring or even get it going when it had been to half a dozen other places and it had not worked out. And they basically came to us. Mm. And I was driving for Mr. Gulbenkian. You probably don't remember. He's a very, very wealthy gentleman. Mm. And his wife. And they loved Palominos. And so I produced and showed quite a few of those in the early days. And then we went on to these things like the Pitney Bows.
When yes.
It first started at White City with some small ponies where you trotted up and down, the lady crossed the path and, you know, crossed a zebra crossing and you had to stop. It was the really early days of those type of competitions.
Yeah.
And all these odds and ends of ponies that came our way had to be broken to drive. Because Chris and I had spent our childhood riding show ponies in 12-2, 13-2, 14-2, show hats, you name it, it was done. Mm. But they all had to go in harness. And they did. And I have to say, it made many, many ponies or horses that would probably have finished up not living, gave them a purpose in life. And some of these animals turned out really well and went on to do extremely well in the show ring and were sold from here to, I can remember, Sir Nigel Coleman having a beautiful black horse that came here, a Hackney horse. And that had been around a little bit and it wasn't a good animal. And I can remember that coming here. And I've told Sarah and Jen so many times about this horse. We had to run him in hobbles. We had what they call a running W.
Yes.
It's not heard of today, but was, in my opinion, a fantastic aid, because
huge lifeline.
Yeah, and if they were going to run away or have a go and they suddenly find they were only on three legs, they very seldom did anything.
Mm.
And this particular horse had been around and it was stunning. And we worked him in a running W and occasionally one leg up. Eventually the horse came right. And I showed that horse to Nigel Coleman in a Lawton gig. And we didn't trim his legs out. He was dark legged in front and white behind. And I ran him in elastic bands, quite thick elastic bands on his forelegs. Mm-hmm. In his head, he thought he'd got hobbles.
Yeah. Yeah, very clever, very clever.
And he won many classes, and Sir Nigel never, ever got over the fact we got this horse going, and nobody was ever told how we got it going. And he went on to do very well with it afterwards
mm.
as an older horse. But all those sort of tricks came from older ostlers. You know, my father got a lot of his knowledge from these older people that were still doing horses in those days. Mm. And I suppose that's how Chris and I learned. And we only learned through experience and through having a father that said, that's what you've got to do. And he did it. But we've said, Sarah and I and Jen have said so many times, if Grandad was here, he'd never believe what it's like now.
No. You wouldn't. But even tell Minter about Peggy and Portia.
Peggy and Portia, which were two of the best mares, I think, probably, that have been shown even to this day.
They were stunning.
We had our eye on, or he had his eye on them, when Nicholson, the brewers up in Sunderland, Vaux Brewery, first took that pair of horses on, and I think they were part of his first team, and they had a lot of trouble with these leaders, and they smashed up quite a few times, and he abandoned them. But they then went on to working on the brewery shift, delivering beer.
If nothing else, wouldn't it?
Until one day when they had an episode in that, and they were kickers beyond anybody's imagination. And my father tracked them down and found them in a riding school, looking as poor as crows, and bought them home. And I can remember they weren't just dirty, they were nasty animals. They would stand and let you put their tack on and be the sweetest, kindest, loveliest animals ever. And you could be driving them for 1 hour, 2 hours, 3 hours, 5 hours, and then they'd have a go. And then they'd kick the dash off the vehicle. And this, in the end, he said, well, they're going to do it, and they will do it, and they did do it. And we worked them and worked them and worked them. And they kind of changed a bit. But I can remember going to one of the very early shows. I think Sarah was just born. Well, you were 10 days old. And we went to Blackpool to one of the first all-in sort of competitions, singles, pairs, you know, unicorns, da-di-da. And we put the gig on because I was showing one of them in a gig and the two of them as a pair in the Spider Phaeton, we hoped. And in the back of the lorry was a spare dash, or two spare dashes. And I went in the class with Portia, who was the most stunning of the two, and won it, and came out. And Sandy Watley was there, and he said, you were lucky with that one. And I said, well, fingers crossed, we'd only done two strides. She kicked like a pig and kicked the dash off the vehicle. So then we put them in pair and went in the pair class, and they behaved and won it. And then we won the Supreme Championship. And was I glad when that day was over? Because you never kind of knew, because they were 100%, but they could kick like you've never seen. Oof. I mean, over the pole and kick a dash, wallop, gone. Terrible. Yeah.
And there was no dirty track, was there? I mean, it's just fascinating because I drive mares, as Minter knows, and, you know, there's always just that edge. There's always the edge. But what was it about these two that would just take it? Would anything trigger, or would it just come out of nowhere?
I think the time before we had them, I think they got away with something when they went wrong in the lead of the team. And then because the horses were still working in brewery wagons, et cetera, et cetera, and I think he had some pretty tough sort of older grooms working for him at that time. I mean, we're back, 51 or 52 years, that they all thought they were going to get these horses going. And along the way, everybody who had something to do with them, they smashed up. And it I think it just became a habit with them that they could do it, and they knew they could do it, and they did do it.
Mm.
But they were eventually sold, as you probably know, to Georgina Brush.
Mm.
And I know when they saw, I think I won at the BBS show, and Georgie's husband,
Alan Turner.
That's him, yeah, came over and wanted to buy them. And I know my father said, look, these horses are not 100% straight. If you want to come to the yard and drive these horses a few times, I might sell them to you. But I want you to know the horses. And that is what they did. And they bought them. And eventually, and she did very well with them.
Yeah, she did. Yeah.
I don't know what happened to them in the end, and I don't know whether they ever had problems or not. But by that time, they got a bit of age about them anyway. And and maybe they had just given up. In those days, you know, they were stunning. And there was competition, but not as many Gelderlanders and that type of horse about then as a popular.
No, but you had numbers. I mean, I remember seeing you drive them at Smith's Salon, and then it must have been the following year, Georgina driving them. And we're going back some years now. But there were numbers in those classes. There was nothing rare. Yeah. Anything under 20 in a class like that.
Exactly.
That main arena at Smith's Lawn was jam-packed with pairs.
Yeah, it was. Yeah.
Yeah.
I can remember going around there with my tongue in my... thinking when to get out. But it didn't. But that's the excitement of those sort of horses.
Oh, yes.
I'd love that. He loved that, didn't he?
He, if a horse went in harness and did its job, he didn't want that horse.
It's boring.
He wanted all the fight and the rearing and the performance and the. And I have to say that when those difficult horses came good, they were the best.
Yes. Yeah.
You know, they would go forever and do whatever job you wanted them to do. But excitement was what he wanted, wasn't it? With you and with me. And, you know, all these scurry ponies and these young things that we've had and dealt with and chipped over with and done everything else with, he would say, stick at it because it will come good in the end. Mm. And I think out of all the scurry ponies that didn't make it, there was just one.
Yeah, yeah.
He did make it. He just did get time to the Horse of the Year show, but he wasn't nice.
Mm. But it is with most things, it is time, isn't it? Time, always.
Time and tolerance, and them just understanding that we're just going to keep going on at this, come what may. And you know, see who cracks first. And then you come to an agreement almost. It is only ever an agreement with those.
Yeah.
Definitely. Because you always know somebody might just push the boundaries a little bit. You always hope it's going to be you, not them. So talking about the scurry driving, tell us, because you must have been right in on the, well, if you did the Pitney Bowes, so you went on to scurrying after that, I suppose, that all started.
Yes, I didn't start when scurrying with horses first began. I've got two very young children then, and I had made my mind up. I wasn't going to get too involved until the youngest was 5 years old, because... I knew it would take over. But I was always involved. I was always here on the farm. I was always doing horses, and so were they. But then my father had an order for a film, Escape in the Dark, which was filmed in a colliery with pit ponies, and he bought, don't ask how many, but a lot. And along the way, the scurry driving, it was with big horses then, of course, was coming to the fore, and then there was mention of it being turned of ponies to come into it too, and I just drew from one pony that was around with another pony that was around, whatever color, shape, size, and broke them and put them together and kind of went for it a bit, and it sort of got hold, and it was so exciting. It was such fun. The early days, I think, were much more fun than the latter ones. The classes were very big. lots of people in the class, great camaraderie. I'm not saying that's not like that now, but it is very different. The classes are much smaller, and it's like everything. These things have changed. Private driving has changed. Coaching's changed. We run a livery yard now. Mm. Just don't really want to go there. Riding horses, I'm talking about, not driving.
Yeah.
Very different. But
you must have seen the vehicles change on the Scurrying as well. What did you start off in? Whatever happened to be on the others?
A very, very lovely four-wheel dog cart that was miniature and original. It was eventually sold through Gary Docking, probably 10, 12, 15 years ago, something like that, to the lady that drove Palominos.
I can't remember her name.
I don't know her name, but it was through Gary. And it was a beautiful little dog car, absolutely beautiful. And I rolled it a few times, which didn't help it greatly. And the first two ponies that I competed with were Sarah and Jen's Levain ponies.
Okay.
That my father bought for them. They weren't part of the film bunch. They were two ponies that came one after the other that my father bought the first one as a four-year-old, saw a kiddie sitting on it at the sale, thought it looked quiet, bought it, it came home, and that was Sarah's pony. She was a very good pony, wasn't she? Yeah. Very good too.
Yeah. And a mare.
And a mare, yeah. And then a little while later, it was a Palomino mare. He bought another Palomino from Reading Carriage Sale with a little bit of history under saddle, and that came home. And Jen rode that.
Yeah.
And we went to all the little local shows with Gymkhana ponies, and my husband and I running up and down lead rein, bending, you name it, we did it. And they were the first two ponies that I broke basically for the job, because they were much loved when the girls grew out of them. We didn't want to sell them. So I broke them to harness, and they were called Punch and Judy.
Oh, right, yes. Yes, I remember them.
And they eventually went on to win the Horse of the Year show with me in a traditional vehicle. And then later on, we had the Scurry vehicle built by a friend of my husband's who, they were good at vehicles too.
Yeah.
And when Sarah was 14, well, before that, you were driving, but weren't allowed to drive then. Was it 12?
12.
14, 12. 12. Sarah started scurrying those two ponies. I'd moved on to something else then, scurrying. And you eventually, did you win Horse of the Year show?
Yeah. I think I did.
Same ponies. Mm. Followed by two or three years later, Jen was reserve champion with them.
Wow.
And I don't regret it, but one of my ambitions was that we would all three get into the championship at the Horse of the Year show and be 1, 2, 3. We almost made it.
I think
we were 1, 2, and 4 in the overall. They were great times. We had 10 ponies on the road, 5 pairs.
Yeah, I seem to remember your wagon, and it was just ponies everywhere.
Yeah.
But all seemed well-mannered and all very well organised, but it was like your entourage arrived and just ponies came out of every orifice of the lorry.
Through the girls being interested and their friends who were great help in those days. I mean, we would look back now and think we took all this lot off to Royal Cornwall and wherever else, with 12, 13, 14-year-old kids.
Yeah.
And I look back now and I think, you couldn't do it now, could you?
No.
It couldn't happen.
That's not boring there.
But then, I mean, it was, we look back on it with great pleasure. They were some of the best years. I've had an amazing life, and I could go on about it forever, and I'm still enjoying it at this silly age that I am. But I think we had the best of it.
Mm. I think it's like anything, when it's growing and it's new, and I think it was also a very free time as well, wasn't it? Everybody was really letting their hair down and just trying everything. And it was relatively affordable then as well.
Yeah, of course.
You know, and lots of families involved. And, like, you know, you could take lorry loads of kids off, so you had lots of little helpers.
Yeah.
Yeah, definitely.
And it was fun, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was.
And a good, safe environment, really, because if somebody stepped out of line, they get clipped around the ear by some of the old boys and kicked back into life again. But we all learned. And look at all those people we had just to watch and to look at. I mean, look at the inspiration I got just by watching and saying, they can do it. I want to do that. You know, it was a good time.
I remember going to the Royal Show with 10 Scurry ponies and the team for coaching all on the same day. And now I think, how on earth did we do it? But you did. You just got on with it.
Yeah.
Lots of helpers, like you say, Minta, lots of helpers. But, yeah, the team and 10 ponies.
Well, the ponies had to take second place, really, because I was working for my father. And, you know, the team had to be done, and filming and TV and weddings and all the other things that came with it. And trying to keep, well, the ponies were always ridden and led. They were seldom driven at home, hardly ever. Once they were broken and doing the job, they might have been driven once between one show and another, or maybe not. They knew their job. And we always felt that if they were keen to do it, they would give their utmost. Whereas if you were galloping around the field every day, they'd go in the show ring and think, oh, this is just the same as we were doing at home. Whereas when they were ridden and led at home, they used to trot and hack on and do, you know, we got quite a lot of land here. So we were able to do, or the girls were able to do quite a lot of work with them after school and whenever, when I was working for father and doing the team and, you know, having his team ready for 9:30 in the morning, all tacked up in the vehicle, manes damped over, hooves oiled, reins at the ready. And he would just drive in with his car and get up and off we'd go.
Good that you say that, because I say that occasionally when I've had owners, and that's how I used to have the team ready, and they would just look and go, no, nah,
no. Nah. No, that's how we did it.
That's how I did it with ponies. You know, if my boss wanted to drive, if you had to sit there for an hour, when he walked in through the yard, everything would be spotless, and those ponies would be in the team, sitting ready and waiting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. And he would say, 9:30, I'll be there, and 9:30 he was.
Yeah.
Well, he was good. He was on time. My boss wasn't always on time.
Yeah, well, we had so much else to get through in the day, you see. I mean, in the middle of doing his team and putting horses together. And, you know, the last team of horses he had, the Gelderlanders, we had 16 horses to get four. Can you believe it? 16 Gelderlanders. And they came in different phases, of course.
The very first to have the Gelderlanders, that would have been one of the first Gelder teams in the country, wasn't it?
Yeah.
After Peter and Anne Munt, they were here
all the time.
And they were great.
Nearly moved in, actually.
they would have done if they could have done. But my mother died in 1983, and my father was almost a broken man. And Chris and I said, because he'd always done what he wanted to do in his life and actually served my mother, although she was not connected with horses at all. But we said to him, you need to, let's get a team of horses. He was doing FEI at the time, and he was driving thoroughbreds, show hacks, you name it, smashing up all the time, rolling it over and whatever else, all the time. And so we tried to talk him to going back into coaching, because that's how he was originally before FEI came along. Unfortunately, it was too late for him. You know, he was older when that all began, which he never, ever forgot, really. But we talked him into getting himself a decent team, not going and buying one bay horse that matched another bay horse, etc. Let's go out and get a team. So we went to Holland through the Vanderhoovels, the father, Christian, who would take us around and buy, you know, show us 10 chestnuts, and you can drive them, do whatever. Brought them home. As always with him, he would go to buy two and come back with six because, you know, there was a few that weren't quite the grade, but he thought he could get them going and move them on and make some money, which we did. And along the way, we finished up with 16 of them. And he was getting on in years then. And so the Sarah, particularly, and myself and our two girls in the yard were then having to get these horses going. And so we did have a proper breaking car and breaking harness. And all these horses had been put in Holland, obviously, but they were all very green. And we were trying to put a team together that was pretty safe for an elderly gentleman to drive. And my father was, I think, one of the best coachmen there'd ever been. But because he was so fearless, he didn't care what the horse did or what it might or might not do. But we did, because we were holding the baby and trying to tell him, this horse is not ready for you to drive. We might as well bang your head against the brick wall. So these horses, I can remember you and whoever was in the yard, we had all these Gelderlanders.
All chestnuts.
All chestnuts.
All white socks.
With white socks, yeah. And they would put a horse in, get a horse tacked up. We didn't have a menage or anything in those days. It was just an open field. And we would put a horse in and I'd drive it around for a few minutes and I'd say to the girls, right, leave me alone, I'll be fine. Go and get next one ready. And I would be on that breaking cart all day. They would just feed horses to me, one after the other after the other. And after driving, don't ask, we didn't even have any names for them. It was that one's got three socks, that one's got a stunning, stunning horses. And eventually we managed to select, I don't think the best of the four for him, as show horses, but certainly the best of the four manners and attitude to their job. And the Wheelers were always, I mean, one was an outstanding horse. The other was a little smaller. And every time we showed them, the judges would come up and say, you've still got the small horse in. Well, he was only, what, 2 inches smaller than the one next to him. But the one next to him carried himself big and the other one just did his job. But safe as houses, and it didn't matter how much or how deep the ground was or how whatever went on, you knew these Wheelers were going to be 100%. The leaders are a little different.
Little bright at times, were they?
But we got them going.
Amazing movers.
And he would say, well, I'd rather have that horse. And I'd go, yeah, but you're not having that horse. We're having this horse. He wasn't an easy man, I can tell you, because many, many times when we've got these horses going and things went wrong, I'd be over and get the reins. Don't you ever touch those reins, he would say, till the day we lost him.
Yeah.
I remember pulling him up at Royal Windsor. He went absolutely mad. But I still look back on it and think if I hadn't have done, I don't think we'd have been here now.
Yeah. Well, sometimes you have to step in, especially with these mavericks, because they really get to the stage that they believe their own immortality, I suppose.
Yeah. Yes.
And just occasionally, they don't take into account that everybody else around them on the sidelines doesn't think like they do, can't react like they do, and will probably cause more trouble by interfering. But those who are right next to these mavericks, it's a nightmare because you've got to manage them in some way whilst getting your head blown off.
And they were young, fit horses.
You was always on the back step when we were out driving around here so that she could be down. And when we put like leaders on, it was nothing new for Sarah and I to run from the yard to the village beside the leaders.
The whole way?
The whole way, yeah, probably 2.5 miles. But when you're running alongside a horse that's got a bit of this about it and is going, you actually forget you're running because you're onto that horse.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
But many years prior to my father, to the latter years of his life, I remember Sir Dimmock White. You probably have heard of him.
Yes,
he's
yes.
A coaching man, a lovely, lovely man. One of the, when Chris and I were doing the team when we were 16 and 18, he was sort of at the top. And we came out of the ring one day. I'm not sure what show it was. It could have been Heaven or one of those. And Sir Dimmock died on the box seat.
Oh, my goodness.
And my father wanted to go that way.
Yeah. Well, to a real driver, that is the best exit, isn't it? You're doing what you love.
Yeah.
But not when Sarah and I are in the vehicle with him.
At Royal Windsor. Not really. No.
Not good. When he sprung the team to come out of the ring. My God. I shall never forget that ever, ever, ever. We were going, I'm telling you, out in the old park, not where it is now.
We
came down beside that road motoring.
And it wasn't a long pull-up either out of that.
The gates at the end to stop where the car park is were approaching pretty fast. And I properly got a mouthful. My father never swore, ever, ever, ever.
And they didn't need, that era didn't need to swear. They had a way of absolutely cutting you to the quick.
Yeah. That's something we've always done. We don't swear. We don't have swearing in the yard. Nobody.
It doesn't happen.
We've been brought up like that and it never happens. It's not necessary.
No. Just to look at, she occasionally can just bring everybody to a standstill.
I'm not so sure the present day riding people understand that look, though.
No, they don't.
But now we're all riding and our driving, we've still got some of the equipment. Well, still got a lot of driving tack, actually, some really nice stuff, but nobody wants it now, do they?
No, I think there might be a little bit of a resurgence, though. With attelage coming through, and I've looked over the years, these things have just swelled. I mean, when I was a kid coming over from Ireland, they were burning carriages on the docks and chucking them in the quays, and then they became really, really valuable. Now they're not so valuable, so you know, I think it will come back. We just hope we haven't lost so much. But, there isn't anything to copy anymore, or you know, because that's what a lot of it will be. But you can't beat a really nice, good set of harness. They were made proper, like, in those days.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And were, you know, real skillful.